I'm going to call this session of the Energy Policy Committee meeting to order. We do not yet have a quorum. At some point in the meeting, we'll announce when we have a quorum so that we can move our minutes. Today, we're going to learn about solar energy and the approach we're going to take. I don't think are the mics on?
Nope.
It's another problem with the electric grid.
To flip the. On the wall. Okay. We're going to get somebody who knows more about the sound system. I'm sure everybody watched Super Bowl yesterday, and you're now wondering if we have the same electrical engineers working on our sound system as they had in the Superdome. We'll wait for a minute before we start the presentations until we get the sound up, but what I'll explain first is we're going to go through all the presentations like we've done in this committee, where our presenters have an opportunity to finish presenting, and then at the end we'll have time for member questions. And members, today we will actually have time for member questions. I know there's infinite curiosity and we have just finite time for committee, so that's why we've been trying to give folks an opportunity to do their presentations. But today we're going to do 60 minutes of presentation, and then we'll do 30 minutes of member question. Thank you. It's pretty loud. And we're starting a little bit late, so we'll try to fit in all the member questions that we can in the time that we have. And our first presenter is Nathan Franzen from Geronimo Energy.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Nathan Franzen. I'm the Director of Solar for Geronimo Energy, an Edina-based wind and solar developer. I'm here to talk about the solar photovoltaic market, or commonly known as PV. So for the last 5 years, the solar PV market has completely transformed itself. As a result, PV is now an economically viable energy resource. It has become viable for two main reasons. We've had continued price declines, and number two, because solar provides high-value on-peak power that displaces peaking capacity investments. In 2012, there was over 3.2 gigawatts of solar installed in the U.S. for a total of more than 250,000 systems now installed within the U.S. The solar market itself is broken into three primary sub-markets, namely the residential, the commercial, and the utility-scale markets. Each have their own set of distinct contractors, vendors, manufacturers, and financing entities that work within these markets. However, they all have one thing in common, and that is that the installed cost of solar PV continues to drop. You can see by this chart, all segments of the market have continued to see price declines by quarter. This is showing it from the first quarter of 2011 to the third quarter of 2012. To put it in another way, year-over-year pricing declines in the residential market, about 15% decline, the commercial market 14%, and the utility scale market at 30% decline. And unfortunately, because the market is so dynamic, you can't actually get published pricing for today's installed cost, but I can tell you that the utility scale market in the U.S. is now hovering around $1.70 a watt installed, which is another significant drop just from the third quarter of 2012. These are dramatic changes. So why are we experiencing this tremendous growth? It's due to the fact that solar provides more than just energy to the grid and utilities. Its unique generation profile and its ability to be located anywhere on the grid provides several valuable ancillary benefits to the grid and ratepayers. Now, I'm not going to go through all of these ancillary benefits, but I'm going to focus on the first two, namely the energy and the capacity values, because they're really the bulk of the value that solar provides. So the first is the energy value. Now, here's a local example that shows the average weekday pricing for energy within a cell system. As you can see by the highlighted area, the prices are somewhere in the 50 to 60 range, which is 2 to 3 times the non-peak pricing for energy. Similarly, if we look at the top five super peaks within Xcel's system for the last 3 years and compare that to how our largest solar systems are operating, namely the St. John's solar system and the Minneapolis Convention Center system, we can see that solar is operating at around a 77% capacity factor during all of the super peaks on average. This includes points in time when the cost of energy was upwards of $600 a megawatt hour on July 23rd, 2012. So it is this correlation that allows, I'm going to go back a slide here, it's this correlation that allows utilities to defer and displace peaking capacity requirements because it's available during these super peak periods. Now, some of you may ask, this is all very interesting, but isn't solar still expensive? And someone's going to ask that question, so I'm just going to hit it head on. The answer to that is it depends. It depends because if you're comparing it to retail rates, then yes, it is expensive. But if you're comparing it to how we normally value energy, which is based upon the characteristic profile of a generation resource, we look at that value based upon the specific benefits and attributes that generator provides. If we take a natural gas peaker, for example, its energy can cost upwards of $350 a megawatt hour when you include the capital costs. But we make those investments because they provide a unique and valuable resource to the grid. We need to do the same thing for solar. So I will wrap up by just saying that we can learn a lot by what we achieved in the wind industry. And last week, we saw the effects of what Minnesota's leadership did in that industry with the jobs, the design firms, and the companies that are based here that are now exporting those resources and skills to other parts of the country. We can do the same in solar. We need to utilize the lessons learned from other parts of the country that have already gone through the pricing structure and valuation metrics and move forward with a system that works for us. But I would urge you to act now before the market fully matures, because it will mature, and in 5 years, I do not want a California-based company coming here to install solar. I want a Minnesota-based company with Minnesota jobs, creating jobs in Minnesota. So that is the end of my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next presenter is Tracy Anderson from the 3M Renewable Energy Division. And if you can state your name for the tape and your affiliation, and then go ahead.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much. I am Tracy Anderson. I'm with 3M Company, and I lead our solar business for 3M. 3M is a diverse company, serves a lot of different industries. Our efforts in renewable energy goes back to about 2006 as a formal group, and we supply materials to device manufacturers around the world, so we have a unique perspective of the industry. Again, photovoltaics is the branch of solar having to do with producing electricity from the sun directly. These are the solar panels that many people are familiar with, used in a variety of areas, including utility scale, residential, commercial, industrial, rooftop. The industry itself has grown fairly sizable. Well over 100 million solar panels are produced and installed around the world. So this is actually quite a big business from where it was at just a few years ago. It also was the case that in about 2008, there were only a couple countries in the world that were installing lots of photovoltaic panels, and that was places like Spain and Germany. Now solar is rapidly growing around the world, and the projections through 2016 show rather robust growth for solar in many, many different countries. The other thing that's happened is we're starting to get enough panels installed to be able to see how this technology performs when integrated into the grid. And proven at scale in Germany, which is one of the largest PV installed bases in the world, during the month of May of 2012, upwards of 10% of their total electricity demand came as a result of solar. And it turns out that the solar provided the energy during the peak times of the day when the energy is most expensive. So it's been proven at scale and is a very successful installations in Germany. Prices have dropped, and as a result, it's becoming quite mainstream. You'll see a list of companies that are installing solar across their base. Walmart, for example, has over 144 stores around the U.S. with solar installed on top of it, and they do that because it makes good sense economically. In the United States specifically, we have about 10% of the world's solar panels go into the United States market. Projection is fairly robust. If you look to the future, the U.S. is to be a significant end market. State by state, you can see from the graphic, where the most solar is installed is obviously places like California. Minnesota, we have a start. About 10 megawatts is installed in Minnesota. California is about 1,600 megawatts. New Jersey is about 400 megawatts. So we have a beginning here, but clearly it's the start of an industry. We don't have a mature industry yet in Minnesota for solar. Prices have come down, and that's been a big part of the expansion, and I think Minnesota will benefit from that. 3M is a material supplier. We don't make solar panels. We actually make the materials that customers use to produce solar panels, and these are a variety of different product formats that have been developed and introduced to the industry. So we work broadly with manufacturers around the world. If you are a manufacturer of solar panels, it's a fairly challenging time right now because of overcapacity in the industry and margins have dropped. So prices are down. That's good for consumers, but the industry itself has to get to a point where it's profitable. So it's still working through that. Long-term outlook remains very, very positive because of the incredible demand that exists in this industry on a worldwide basis. As a supplier, 3M is actively participating not just in driving down the cost for solar through lower cost materials, but we're also helping customers increase the power output of these devices. So it's an area for innovation and technology to be able to make an impact. And we're not at the end of the story here yet. The industry has a lot of room on its roadmap to the future to drive out cost per watt, which is the metric that the industry uses. So it's mature in one respect, but still quite embryonic in this respect. So in summary, the industry has gone very rapidly worldwide. There are strong drivers, including energy diversity, having a fuel mix that makes sense. It can be distributed, which can offload demand from the grid. Sustainability arguments are part of the driver, and jobs is another part. Minnesota has a solar resource that's very equivalent to the country of Germany. We get about the same amount of sunshine as Germany does, and Germany has about 31,000 megawatts of solar panels installed in Germany. Minnesota has about 10 megawatts. So it's an interesting reference point, and Germany solar and wind are very big parts of their future energy mix. There's lots of success stories around that. So it's also finally a good business opportunity for Minnesota companies like 3M. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next presenter is John Carroll from Silicon Energy.
I'm John Carroll, Silicon Energy, and we have a little technical snafu. I couldn't get my movie to play, so bear with me. I want to start out with a little demonstration. Works. I hope you can see it. Of course, technical difficulty continues.
Do you want us to pass her?
We have a very large man who is about to jump on our module, which is a very unique module, very robust and durable.
How much do you weigh? 255. And you just jumped on this module and made it bounce all the way to the floor. And 3.5 inches.
And over 2 days, how many people have been on this?
100.
We've had 100 times over this. I mean, this is, like I said, it's an insane.
Would you let him do that one more time?
Okay. You know what? Guys, if it breaks, it's fine. He's done it once. It's so possible.
Oh, he broke it. No, I'm just kidding.
Anyway, here's pass this around. This is a sample module. It's a very durable product. In our company, what we try to do is really look at innovation. That's a big part of what we do. We're firm believers that innovation occurs right next to the assembly line. I want to thank you because all of you here, or most of you here, I think, passed in 2010 the Made in Minnesota bonus legislation, which allowed us to build a $10 million facility up in Mountain Iron, Minnesota. And so we've been able to bring this quality product to your state, and we think it's going to do quite well. I want to talk a little bit about solar incentives and jobs. You know, first of all, I think it's a fact that solar is traveling the same path as traditional energy.
You know, I like to always point out that the oil and gas industry has a 100% write-off and tax credits. That if the solar industry had anywhere near that same level, we wouldn't be here talking to you, talking to states about incentive programs. Investment in solar really means jobs. As others here said, it's a global business. There's a lot of energy supply diversity that's coming from it. The fact of the matter is it produces more jobs per megawatt hour than any other energy industry. And the fact is that when you combine local manufacturing, the type of manufacturing that we do, really doubles the number of local jobs. We're a very strong proponent of what I would call residential and small commercial type projects. We think that drives maximum economic development for a project. And recently, Carl Rabago was here talking about how you incentivize local manufacturing, and it's roughly 2 to 3 times the value of solar. Just to give you a little history, in 2010, you passed legislation. We immediately began construction. Xcel began allocating the Made in Minnesota bonus program alongside the solar rewards program. Our module plant began selling modules in September of 2011. And 9 months later, Xcel, because of the solar reward situation, basically closed down the program. So our small little factory really has only availed itself to about 9 months worth of incentives out of the 5 years that we've made available. And to date, you know, roughly 9% of the incentive applications have come to us. In terms of the future, I mean, we really strongly believe that the incentive program for Made in Minnesota needs to be reauthorized. It needs to be a statewide program. We're advocating moving it to the Department of Energy Resources as opposed to, you know, having it be administered by the utilities themselves. I think Xcel agrees with that. We're behind the fact that it should be a performance-based incentive, and it should be a stable, long-term program. I think long-term stability, more than anything else, needs to be the message that's driven through to the market. Here is some of our product in action. Obviously, because it's such a durable product, it can be used as a building integrated approach. You've got it here as a carport, here as an awning. It's our standard rooftop application. And then here on the left side, you have, it shows our snow shedding capability. It doesn't have a lip on the bottom, so snow, once the sun comes out, drops off almost immediately. And then right on the right side, you'll see probably the most aggressive use of solar. That is a seawall in Vashon Island that is open to the ocean right there. I don't think you'll see too many other products used in that manner. I want to talk a little bit about local manufacturing impact. The state of Washington, they've done a North American Industries classification study on our product that showed for every $1 million of solar installations, and you know, divorce that from incentives, I'm talking about installed cost of solar, produces 13.5 direct jobs and 24.5 indirect jobs. It's a money multiplier effect that comes out of the econometric model. The total output for $1 million spent is roughly $4.25 million. That's the ripple effect. We try to source as many of our components for our module locally as possible. Here in this state, we source from 3M. We also source from Cardinal Glass. Finally, my last slide here. Again, the key issue for us is long-term stability. And we would hope that whatever program we come up with, it promotes innovation. You know, I think there's a lot of ideas floating around in the solar business. Everybody has a unique idea and concept and design. I'm hopeful that we don't migrate to the least cost option, that there's room to promote innovation, because the winner, I think, still needs to be developed. We need to give it time to develop. The other key point is volume drives manufacturing and installation efficiency. We have an expensive product, but that's because our volume is so low here in this state. We're trying to build volume. We need to pay attention that whatever we do, we need to promote the existing federal subsidies that are out there into the financing of these programs, make them available, make sure that people are availing themselves to the federal incentives. There's a 30% tax credit. There's also accelerated depreciation available. You want that in these projects. You don't want to exclude it. I think transparent reporting is a must. I think with the Xcel situation here, there's been some issues understanding where we were at in the program. And then last, my other large point is that when you do incentivize solar, I think the biggest bang for your buck from an economic development perspective is on residential and small commercial projects. You do large scale, utility scale solar, it's going to be fewer jobs, and out-of-state Chinese modules, out-of-state developers, out-of-state development and investment. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you. I'm just glad you didn't ask my teenage boys to test that panel at my house. Scott Schroeder is the next testifier from Honeywell.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson, members of the committee. I'm Scott Schroeder from Honeywell International's Energy Services business. I was asked to present today as a user installer of the panels. Federal government, your committee, are looking at a comprehensive approach to this, and that's what we advocate our facilities do. And by way of example, I brought in a higher education institution in the upper Midwest, took an approach that they bundled a lot of different opportunities for energy efficiency, and were able to put together a program that included, in the lower right there, a sustainability project. That's a green roof that prevents rainwater and a 30-kilowatt array that supplies that particular building as part of a project that had a 16-year payback and reduced the energy use in the five buildings at 42% from their baseline. So what you should take from this very busy slide of all the different pieces as they come together is there are some things that I call accretive to the bundle, things like plumbing, some lighting controls that'll pay back in a shorter time period, 7 to 10 years. And then there's those things that take that are dilutive to the bundle, 20-year paybacks and more, that really get at the infrastructure and at the sustainability of the buildings. This particular project, they looked at major energy retrofits from the mechanical systems perspective. And the renewable or sustainable projects were part of a pilot that included a lot of local utility rebates and subsidies. The other thing to take away from this is as you address a comprehensive approach to your facility, if you do those lower hanging fruit, as we like to refer to them, the 7, 6, 5 year payback items, and you don't put a comprehensive strategy together, you may miss the opportunity to get a bundled package in that allows you for a 16-year payback. So this date, somewhere between 15 to 20 years is the payback. And as we look at those items that allow you to put a bundle together, we're seeing solar as a much more viable opportunity, as the previous presenters have recommended. And we see it growing in the future. The utility costs in our area are likely to continue to increase, and we're definitely going to see an opportunity to include these in our bundles. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next we have Rebecca Lundberg from Powerfully Green. Her business is not located in my legislative district, but it's in my Senate district from Champlin, Minnesota.
I'm Rebecca Lundberg, and I am president and CEO of my own small women-owned business, Powerfully Green, and I'm really happy to be here. Thank you so much for taking time to learn a little bit about solar and hear from your colleagues and constituents. I am a NABCEP certified solar installer, and I actually have a master's degree in education, but I've been installing solar for 7 years, and I have to tell you that the best part of my job is working with people. I actually spend most of my days on the roof, and when we're finished doing the installation of solar panels, we go down usually to the basement and boot up the inverter to make sure it's working, and then we bring the homeowner out, and this is Pat Hadland in Scandia, Minnesota, because on a sunny day, that meter, when we've turned that inverter on, will almost always start spinning backwards. And it's the most remarkable thing to be a part of, because this is the first time that the power of solar is real to that homeowner. They've wanted solar probably their whole lives, some of them. And here I had the opportunity to make it real for them, and here she is trying to get a little video snippet to send it to friends out of state, because this is a dream come true for her. And my hope is to make more people be able to avail themselves of this energy resource. It's a really incredible thing, and she becomes very conscientious now about her energy consumption. This was one of the first projects that I did. It's a little bungalow in South Minneapolis. It has a pretty modest solar electric system and a single solar air heater on the south wall. It gets 100% of its electricity and 30% of its heat from these solar systems. Proof that solar works in Minnesota. Here's another installation up in Rogers, Minnesota. And for a residential installation, it's fairly large. This homeowner has a southeast and a southwest facing roof. But it's a really good example of how distributed generation for solar, putting the solar resource where it's being used, on the house or on the office or as a carport for the office, is a really great way to maximize existing space. We don't need to take up any kind of green field. The roof is already there doing not much of anything. And now we've put solar parallel to the roof surface, a 6.8 kilowatt solar system with made in Minnesota silicon energy panels. And now that house is powered by the sun. I'm really proud to have made in Minnesota options, and I think that's one of the great things that the legislation did for us a few years ago, is to make that incentive program. Supporting locally made was a fantastic move. I'm really proud to be working with Minnesota companies. And one of the highlights of my last year was going to the groundbreaking up in Mountain Iron in the middle of the Iron Range for a multi-million dollar solar plant. And what a delightful thing. We had customers come up to see it and jump up and down on the solar panels. To think that we could make these in Minnesota is marvelous. And as a solar installer, I go to international trade shows, and I have to tell you that this is a really innovative product. The testing has proven it to be the most durable in the world, and I feel hopeful that this could put Minnesota on the solar map. We're really, really excited, and I thank you for helping to make that happen. Demand is absolutely huge for this. As an installer, I do a lot of residential and small commercial installations, and I have customers waiting in line. But alas, that's the dilemma. I was here 2 years ago to testify to help in the writing of that Made in Minnesota legislation, and I think I understand a little bit about the intent. And it was supposed to touch a lot of people, and I feel like it touched a lot of commercial installations, some residential customers, and they're all so excited. But I've got this waiting list of people who are emailing me and calling me and saying, when is it going to open up again? When is it going to open up again? And so I would like to advocate that residents are citizens, citizens are voters, and it's the voters that are demanding this. They're excited about solar, and we need to make it happen for them. This map shows solar working, the solar level of energy around the world. The darker the red, the more solar energy hits the planet. So clearly Africa is a really good place for solar. But for a minute, compare the United States and the color we have there to Europe. Notably, Germany has the most installed solar in the world. And yet, when we talk about how much solar energy we have the capacity for, we talk about peak sun hours. Germany has 3.1 peak sun hours a day of energy. Minnesota has 4.6. We have significantly more sun power than Germany. Interestingly enough, New Jersey, which is the number two solar state in our country, second only to California, New Jersey has 4.7 sun hours. Very close to Minnesota's sun level of energy, and yet they're installing about 30 megawatts a month of solar in New Jersey, and it's all about policy there. So Minnesota has the same solar resource as Houston, Texas, and parts of Florida. We have yet to take advantage of that, but we have lots of enthusiasm for it. From my perspective, the things that we need to make a stable, strong solar industry here would be, first of all, stable incentives so they don't run out and leave customers waiting. I would like to see something that was planned out for 10 years so that it would relieve the uncertainty of those customers. Are there rebates? Are there not rebates? I read in the paper there aren't rebates. So we could remove that and help build confidence. I would like to see a focus on distributed generation because we'd be using existing roof space and we wouldn't need to build additional transmission lines for it. It grows jobs, as was brought up earlier. There's a lot. You can't outsource my boots on your roof. You have to use local contractors, local electricians, and local system designers. And the IKEA store is an example. I'm really excited about having a big solar energy system on the IKEA store in Bloomington. Unfortunately, it was such a large installation that not only didn't it use Minnesota contractors, it didn't even go out to bid in Minnesota. They brought in contractors from another state, they brought in solar panels from another state, and they used something like 8 electricians to do some of the wiring. And I would like to suggest that that's not the best way to use our funds in Minnesota. If we focused on smaller installations, distributed generation sort of systems, then we would do a better job growing local jobs. And there's lots of people who are being trained in Minnesota to do solar, and we have the capacity to fill that need. I would like to see us strengthen that made in Minnesota so we can support local industry and perhaps legislate that 50% of it should go to residents this time to compensate for what happened the last time so that it was a good split, but a lot of those residential voters also had the option to make solar part of their future. Minnesotans want solar. They feel like they're part of the energy future, and a lot of times they ask me, well, how do I decide, like, which system would work best? Without exception, they want to choose a locally made product. The only thing that makes them choose something out of state or out of the country is cost. So if we can incentivize, grow that local solar manufacturing, our customers will always choose a locally made product. And really the question is, what's the real cost of not fully supporting renewable energy and local manufacturing? I was here to hear testimony recently where cities were asking for help to pay for cleanup of storm catches. And that was because the bituminous asphalt had coal ash as filler, and it was washing into the storm catches, creating a toxic waste place for children to play in. So there are other costs to not using renewable energy. Here's a beautiful picture of a 10-kilowatt system, energy independence. Another system, this is my home office in Champlin, Minnesota, and we have beautiful building-integrated solar pergola over our patio using the Made in Minnesota Silicon Energy solar panels. Almost always, we install a monitoring system when we put solar in so the customer can see their solar working. On the left-hand side, the green line is the solar production, and the red line is their house consumption. And it's really interesting because we put it in so they can see their solar working, and they can show the people they work with and the people they, you know, their relatives. But invariably, they start asking about their house consumption. How do I turn that off? And they become really smart energy consumers at the same time. So solar installations work hand in hand with energy efficiency. And finally, we have the technology now. My home, my office, and my car are powered by the sun.
Thank you. Our next presenter is Jason Edens from the Rural Energy Alliance. And if, when you introduce yourself, you could tell us where your business is located, that would be great. I know we have people here from all over the state of Minnesota, but we haven't done a good job of calling out locations except for the person who lived near me. I believe I have door knocked on that house before for another state representative.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jason Edens, and I work for a nonprofit solar thermal manufacturer based in a small community in north central Minnesota called Pine River. So I'm the first here today to speak about solar thermal, which is a solar technology that heats our homes and our buildings and our businesses and our agricultural facilities. So once again, we are based in a very small community in north central Minnesota, and we employ about 15 to 20 people with living wage jobs in a community of 900 people. So first of all, I would also like to reiterate something that was said earlier, which is the fact that energy efficiency always trumps renewable energy. Oftentimes, people are very fired up about solar, and yet they put the cart before the horse in that they do solar before energy efficiency. And like the gentleman from Honeywell mentioned, the low-hanging fruit is definitely energy efficiency. Both solar electricity and solar thermal is something that we do long after we've improved the overall efficiency of our homes and businesses. Quite frankly, the cheapest BTU, the cheapest kilowatt hour, is the one that we never use. So again, I want to point out that we're talking about solar heat here, which is a dramatically different technology from solar electricity. And people often ask us, why solar heat? You know, despite the fact that PV or solar electricity is really the darling of the solar industry right now, solar heat has a very important role to play. Quite frankly, in northern climates like ours, the vast majority of the energy that we use is for our heating loads, both for heating our homes and for heating our water and a variety of other thermal loads. So solar heat has a very important role to play in our climate, and has a very important role to play in the solar industry as a whole. You'll see that between space heating and water heating, about 70% of all the energy that we typically use in a northern climate like Minnesota is for our heating loads. So we manufacture a solar air heating technology, which directly provides heat to homes, businesses, manufacturing facilities, plane hangars, warehouses, distribution facilities, schools, etc. Here's one example that we just did recently. It's an airport, and obviously buildings like this are a dime a dozen. There are hundreds of millions of square feet of buildings like this one around the country that could benefit dramatically from the solar thermal technology that we manufacture. So in short, the technology that we manufacture is a space heating technology. We're literally recirculating building air through an array of solar thermal collectors and delivering it back to the building, thereby reducing overall energy. And like Rebecca pointed out earlier, it's easy to do about 30% of a home or a business's overall heating load from a solar thermal technology. So here are a handful of other installations. You can see fire halls, schools, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers in the upper left, the Leech Lake Reservation Division of Resource Management, Department of Public Works. All these buildings can benefit dramatically from solar thermal. And then also I want to point out that our organization, like I mentioned, is organized as a nonprofit. And you might have wondered, why would a solar thermal manufacturer that's creating jobs and distributing product all across the country has chosen to organize as a nonprofit? We are also pioneering a very unique application of solar heat. In fact, it's a nationally unique application. We are delivering solar heat to low-income families on public energy assistance as a long-term, clean, and domestic solution to low-income fuel poverty. Each and every year in the state of Minnesota, we spend approximately $100 million serving half of the eligible population of families that really struggle to make ends meet because of the high cost of home heating. Rather than spending $100 million each and every year, our organization is advancing the solution of using solar heat to permanently move families from impoverished to empowered. And this application of solar heat, again, is nationally unique. And although our organization has been pioneering this application, it's now being referred to nationally as the Minnesota model. So when we think about energy policy, this is a great opportunity for the state to really continue to demonstrate how we can ensure the well-being of our low-income communities using a clean energy Minnesota-made technology. So our organization is not only a solar thermal manufacturer, we're also a solar design build firm, quite like Rebecca's. In fact, last year alone, we did about 200 solar thermal and solar electric installations in the state of Minnesota, half of which were for low-income families. So although solar is obviously appropriate for both commercial and residential applications, although solar is obviously appropriate for both upper-income and lower-income applications, the truth of the matter is our low-income communities could benefit from the stabilization of energy costs. And if we can do that with a clean energy technology that's creating jobs in our own state and basically manage energy assistance in a much more effective and wise way, it's a win-win solution for all of us. So as a design build firm, we work with actually all of the technologies that are represented today. 10K Solar, Silicon Energy, Solar Skies, and of course our own technology. In fact, we're about to do a 32 kilowatts solar electric installation with 10K product right here in the metro and right hand up an electric cooperative. So I really appreciate your interest in solar. I appreciate your willingness to learn more about these various appropriate technologies. And in conclusion, I will also point out that solar is a highly appropriate and effective technology, and I speak from personal experience. As a general contractor, I've lived with solar electricity and solar heat for 15 years, and it provides about 85% of all the energy that I use in my home. So we can all do this at our homes and our businesses, and once again, thank you for your interest.
Thank you. Our next presenter is John Frederick from Silent Power.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Frederick, and I'm the CEO of Silent Power. Silent Power is a manufacturer of energy storage devices, and we're located in Baxter, Minnesota, part of the Brainerd Lakes area. Energy storage is very complementary to solar. And if you don't remember anything else from this afternoon, please remember the slide in front of you. And what this really shows is a 24-hour period. It happens to be California's demand curve, but it could be any state or any utility. And it shows that some of the other presenters have spoken about that solar energy helps reduce that peak, and that's represented by the dotted line is the normal demand curve. The blue line represents the result after solar energy. And then the red line represents the effect of when you couple solar energy with energy storage. And why this is significant is that black line is what utilities build for grid demand. That's not only peaking generators, that's transmission. And something very expensive is distribution plant to actually get the electricity to your home. That's all very, very expensive to hit that peak, you know, that's really used for a short amount of time. And that money ends up in your electric bill and in your constituents' electric bill. And so you can see that solar combined with energy storage could really help reduce the amount of generation and plant that's needed to deliver electricity. Energy storage can actually help stabilize renewable energy as well, and whether it's solar or wind, both of those renewable resources are somewhat intermittent due to cloud cover or varying wind speed. Energy storage helps absorb peaks and can fill in the valleys to basically stabilize that power. As I mentioned, we're up in Baxter, Minnesota. We employ 21 people in that community. And I would guess that we probably provide at least half that many board jobs to a list of Minnesota suppliers. So we are a manufacturer, and we've listed some of the suppliers to Silent Power. All of these are in the state of Minnesota. We provide storage at the edge of the grid, and in addition to those benefits to society and utilities of lowering that peak demand, we also could provide backup to a home or business. And unfortunately, our equipment is not installed in the Superdome. We're a national firm. We're doing a lot of work here in Minnesota. Jason just mentioned that Wright-Hennepin Electric, just to the west in Rockford, we are part of that project. They are coupling solar energy with energy storage to get the combined benefit you saw on some of the previous slides. But we work nationally, and we work with some of the utilities around the country. And, you know, as small as we are with 21 people, you know, we're actually considered the leader in this area. Final slide. This is a busy slide, but I want you to know that, you know, Minnesota has been very progressive in terms of energy efficiency and energy storage. States such as California have been also very aggressive on renewable portfolio standards. And one of the things that California actually passed about 18 months ago was a bill to actually look at a portfolio standard for energy storage. So that's quite common with renewable energy. We have one here in the state. But this is states that are progressive on renewable energy are also beginning to look at energy storage as a standard for their states. And in addition to this, I would mention that Germany just passed some legislation, I believe it was last week, where, you know, they've always been a leader in solar energy, but they've actually passed legislation where they'll actually provide a national rebate to energy for energy storage to couple with that. So I'll be available after the session today or during the question period and be happy to answer more questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next presenter is Randy Hagen from Solar Skies.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for having us here today. I'm Randy Hagen, president of Solar Skies Manufacturing. We're a solar thermal manufacturing company based in Alexandria, Minnesota. This is our seventh year in business, and after millions of dollars of investment in 7 years, we still feel like we're a startup. So we hope to have that change for us here. We sell both in national and international markets. We are approved in Canada, and we are now just getting into some military sales. So you'll find our product in Guantanamo Bay and as far away as Guam. We've got all the necessary certifications. A large part of our market, a growing part of our market, is Hawaii also. So it's fun to think that Minnesota Power goes that far. The slide on the left are the collectors, one of the 15 collectors that we are rated for and manufacture in Minnesota. We also sell a complete line balance of system components, which are comprised of pumps, tanks, and controllers that support a solar thermal system. Solar thermal system is different than the solar electric systems you've heard about today. Jason Eden's product, we also produce heat, but it's liquid instead of hot air. So solar thermal collector is going to absorb the heat, and through a series of manifolds, pumps, and heat transfer fluid, that gets exchanged to heat collection reservoirs and is used however you would like. And this is true in small residential systems all the way to large-scale systems. Some of the solar thermal opportunities that you'll find our products on, this is a busy slide, but I picked a lot of Minnesota examples here. You'll notice the Paul Wellstone apartments in the Midwest, Kalahari Water Park, Carleton College, heating their dormitories, Brainerd, a VA clinic, a large greenhouse in Michigan, a ground mount, a large collector array for swimming pools in Chicago, and our largest install, 4 semi-loads of collectors from Alexandria, are now heating hot water for inmates in Maricopa County, Arizona. A couple Minnesota examples that I want to highlight here. University of Minnesota on their Morris campus, they're using 32 of our collectors to do their swimming pool heating, offsetting about 15 tons of CO2 annually. And one right near to this area, Ramsey County Law Enforcement Center, a little bit bigger project, 35 of our collectors, and we're doing about 40% of the hot water load, so I am told, for their nearly 600 inmates there and staff. And this also is reducing 15 to 17 metric tons of CO2 annually. And the largest array here in Minnesota, done by District Energy, this is on the St. Paul River Center. Now, unfortunately, this was not our product. There was no technology in Minnesota at the time that could develop this. But we looked at this project as what can happen with Minnesota made with solar thermal technology. The good news is that was then, and this is now. After years of development and, again, millions of dollars in investment, Solar Skies in Minnesota is the only full-plate absorber welding system in United States or Canada, and we can build these types of collectors. So we're excited about the opportunity and potential for our company going forward. This is a look at some of the product coming off of that new line. Be happy to talk to anybody about that. There is no finer product produced anywhere in the world. This is total state-of-the-art product. So Minnesota has a great solar resource. We have world-class manufacturing. So what is missing for solar thermal to take off? We need equity in the incentive programs. I applaud what the group has done here, what our legislature has done to bring solar about in Minnesota. We need to have the inclusion of solar thermal in that, because when we're not pulled along, in effect, we're put down. And most of our sales, as you can see, are occurring out of this state. At your leisure, you can read this slide nationally what needs to be done to help the solar thermal industry grow. Bill Guiney from Johnson Controls, he's been a big advocate and a big partner in some of our projects. He's written a white paper that I'd like to draw your attention to also. And he cites solar thermal is a cost-effective measure for knocking out CO2. And they feel, as you can tell in the title here, solar thermal energy's time has come. What I'd like to call out here finally for the state, certainly renewable energy of all kinds must remain incentivized here in the state. President Bill Clinton spoke at our SEIA convention in Orlando this fall. He said for every $22 in dollars that went to fossil fuels, a dollar goes to solar energy. So all over the board, renewable energy must be incentivized. Solar thermal must remain an equal part of that. Thank you.
Thank you. Wayne LaForge is our next presenter, and while he's coming down, I'll let you know that I grew up in a house that had solar thermal hot water, so we never had natural gas into our house when I was growing up, and we never needed electricity to heat the water because we had the solar thermal on the roof.
Good afternoon.
Thank you. Go ahead and state your name and your affiliation for the tape.
Good afternoon. I'm Wayne LaForge, General Manager of Sundial Solar. We design and install solar PV systems. We are based out of Minneapolis. You might think I'm here to talk about solar, but I'm not. I'm here to talk about jobs. You might ask yourself, what job sector has the greatest growth potential and provides the most benefit to the state of our environment? The answer is solar. Solar benefits, strengthens the grid, stimulates job growth, keeps most of the money local, reduces independence on foreign oil, mitigates power loss and natural disasters, is a source of backup power in emergencies. For Sundial Solar, over 90% of our payables stay in Minnesota, from the modules we use, our electrical equipment, crane services, labor, cement blocks, and the list goes on and on. Environmental benefits, cleaner energy, helps curb climate change, reduces coal and oil deaths, less landform destruction, promotes habitat conservation. A little bit about Sundial Solar. We do solar in the woods. This is Will Steger's home up in Ely, Minnesota. Solar in the city, small solar arrays or large arrays. In 2000, John Kramer started Sundial Solar down in Florida. John then pedaled back to Minnesota in 2006. In 2006, he partnered up with Hal Haverson, and the two of them worked with no employees. 2008, still with no state or utility rebate programs, they worked again with, still with no employees. Then in 2010, state and Excel rebate programs came into effect. He hired 6 employees in 4 months. I was one of those lucky employees. Now today, we have 16 employees, and we are growing strong. What does the future bring? If Minnesota would adopt a program that pays for the true value of solar, we could employ 100 times what we do now. That's what the future could hold for all of us. Solar systems in Minnesota just make good economic sense. Sum it up, solar equals jobs in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Helping us get back on time. Joel Cannon from 10K Solar.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. I'm Erica Forsman, sales manager with 10K Solar, and we provide a world-class, fully integrated PV power plant that's manufactured here in Bloomington. 10K Solar chose to focus its innovation on the flat roof commercial market. What we do is provide a complete system to our integrators that's easy to design, it's easy to sell, and it's easy to install. Part of that proprietary technology is the use of a reflector, which you can see on this photo. It's a 3M film. It allows us to capture all of the light hitting that rooftop space, which means that our installers selling our product can now offer a product that produces more energy off of that commercial roof.
as the sales manager, I've had the privilege of working with a number of our integrators here locally in Minnesota. And I've been able to see the fact that if they use an innovative technology like 10K Solar, they can differentiate themselves in the market and grow their business. We not only work with a number of installation partners here in Minnesota, but we also have installations in 18 states and 6 countries, all done with Minnesota-made product. This not only means more jobs at 10K Solar, which includes engineering, manufacturing, and sales jobs, but it also means more jobs for our local suppliers, which includes Alexandria Extrusions, Cardinal Glass, and Digi International. I'll now turn it over to Joel.
Thanks, Erica. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I told Erica I didn't need to join her, and I was obviously right, but she insisted I come along to talk about a little bit of the history of the company. I'll do this in probably about 45 seconds. We've been incorporated in Minnesota since January of 2008. Dallas Meyer, my business partner, PhD in materials, very talented guy, ran engineering at Seagate, the disk drive company, went out to Silicon Valley, worked for some big solar companies, and very quickly realized he had a better idea. Came back here to Minnesota to start a company, worked with his own money and time for about a year. I met him in January of 2009. We hit it off and decided to bring the company out of the garage and take the technology and scale it. We are focused on the idea that solar needs to be built as a system, so that by building the entire system from everything from sunlight to AC energy, we can take cost out and make the system more reliable. What you see on the chart is the change in the percentage of cost of a solar system that's represented by the solar module or the solar panel. As you can see, over the last few years, that has percentage has reduced. As solar panels become less expensive, the other components relative to the cost of the system become larger contributors. And so engineering the entire system to take cost out across the board is very important. That's, I think, all we really want to say. We've got a strong partnership with 3M. They make a great reflective film that makes a huge difference in how efficient our flat rooftop product is. We've attracted nearly $30 million in investment money from outside the state and actually outside the U.S. To do R&D and production in Minnesota. We've got investors from Asia, from Europe, and we've got electric utility investors in the U.S. as well. So thanks so much for the support of the rebate programs here. It makes tremendous difference to have a stable, reliable base market to build a new technology on. Thank you.
Thank you. And then our last presenter is Lynn Hinkle from the Minnesota Solar Energies Industry Association. And then we will turn it over for member questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're delighted to have this opportunity to talk about solar. My name is Lynn Hinkle. I'm the policy director for the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association. John just told me I have 2 minutes. We're going to see if we can provide some insights in that shorter period of time. Minnesota solar industry has significant assets, many of which you've been able to see and hear about this afternoon, and the potential to attract major investments to Minnesota's economy. To become an investment target for solar, to become a solar industry hub, a state needs 3 things. We'll go back to where this set of ideas came from in a minute when we talk about our first solar manufacturing supply chain roundtable in December of 2010. It needs a clear and significant demand signal. It needs a stable and diverse solar supply chain. It needs a clean energy statutory support environment. Compared with other states, Minnesota has an advantage building a solar industry hub because it's got 2 of those 3 key components. You see checked off, we have a stable and diverse solar supply chain. You saw some of that diversity in the presentation so far. We have a clean energy statutory support environment in different components, different elements, but we lack and still need a clear and significant demand signal. Make no mistake, the demand signal has different components, and you've heard people talk about those different components. It is not just one thing. So when Honeywell talks about bundling energy efficiency and using programs that would facilitate private dollars, that's driving a demand signal. When we look at bonding for public buildings and we say some of that ought to be taxpayer dollars to provide solar installations, that's a part of the demand signal. Minnesota solar manufacturing suppliers. This is a little bit of a shift because we're going to go a little bit further behind. You saw some of the presenters so far talk about some of their suppliers. 30-plus, actually it's close to 40 Minnesota manufacturers of materials, components, and final products for the solar industry. What's this represent in terms of jobs? It's significant. It's 1,500 to 1,900. It's probably closer to over 2,000 direct jobs, and an equal number of next-tier manufacturing suppliers all across the state. Well, what do I mean by that? Crenlo in Rochester, a huge manufacturer of a number of different sheet metal products, is supplying into the solar market by building enclosures, J-boxes, but it uses suppliers in Rochester like Fastenal. So you've got a multiplier effect from these folks. Incidentally, one of the suppliers to Silent Power that you saw earlier is Crenlo as well. So there's a lot of matchmaking that's going on in our state to drive different parts of this industry. Finally, you've got installers, developers, distributors, and trainers who are able on the installation side to meet rising demand for solar installations. Minnesota, it becomes a target for investment. With the industry that we have in place, we stop being the place that is flown over by capital and start being a destination. Here's the brochure for the first of five. We've done five solar manufacturing supply chain roundtables since December of 2010, and we're in the process of planning our sixth one. That's it. Here's the map. These are all of the businesses. It's a little bit hard to see, I guess, on this slide, but it's pretty cool to look at the OEMs, the original equipment manufacturers. You've heard Solar Skies and Alexandria. You've heard about Silent Power in Baxter. You hear about Crenlo in Rochester, Dispatch in Lakeville. The list really goes on and on all across the state. The industry is ready. It's mature. It's stable. It needs that clear, significant demand signal. Thanks so much.
Thank you. We have a quorum now. Mr. Vice Chair, would you like to move the minutes?
Madam Chair, I would move adoption of the minutes from January 29.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. We have a number of short chairs here on the inside of the U, and so if people are called up to answer certain questions, you might want to just feel free to grab a chair and stay in the area. I know it was a lot of presenters. We have 11. You probably don't want to all line up on chairs in front of the room, but we'll start with Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I enjoyed the diverse presentations. And I do think I need to correct. There was one of the testifiers stated that they have a system with reflectors that collect 100% of the energy. And I noticed the picture they were referencing didn't have a tracking system, so you don't ensure optimal angle of incidence. Whenever you have a surface interface, you know, if you have glass, it's 4%. And every time you hit interface, you lose efficiency. So I think that, it might be a very effective system, but we got to remember that none of these are going to give us 100%. I do want to state that I do support the solar thermal credit on RPS and efficiency targets because I think it's renewable. And I agree with the chair. This has been used by people, especially in the rural areas of Minnesota, for I think generations, and if we used to have a less reliable power grid, and it was nice that if you lost power, you still had a warm shower, and so I appreciate that. But getting on to some of the questions, there was a presentation by Silicon Energy that has in there reliability and lifetime durability statements. And I'd like to understand what HAST and other testing and how many thermal cycles, and then if they did look at the efficiency of the summer high versus winter low, what was the delta in efficiency in those environments? What is the fogging, the surface finish issues, and then the icing and snow concerns being in Minnesota? And I was just curious, at that panel, was that Gorilla Glass? And then I assume that your product is not using the ingot type process for your silicon sheets. So, and what type of source of your silica? Is it Minnesota sand, or just a little background on that? But reliability and lifetime numbers, since I've had that background in industry, I'd like to understand how you're projecting 100 years.
Okay.
Mr. Carroll, sounds like somebody needs a tour of your plant. To the questions, Mr. Carroll.
Madam Chair, we were lucky to be selected by the National Renewable Energy Labs in Colorado to participate in a test of failure testing regimen. As part of that, some of the finest modules in the world were invited to participate. In essence, what they were doing is torture testing the modules, but I can describe it as follows. They were put in a humidity chamber. The temperature was dropped to minus 45 degrees centigrade. It was increased all the way up to positive 85 degrees centigrade. They then immersed the module in a saline solution and ran electricity through it, and then afterwards flash tested it. This sort of expansion and contraction puts a lot of stress on the solar module. And what happened was that for the standard modules that you see, they have a plastic, a Tedlar backing to them. You saw a lot of cracking created, by the temperature changes. And as a result, through a simulated 18-year period of time, every other module had basically failed the test in one way, shape, form, or another. Our module went through the first 20 years without a problem. They actually ran out of money at year 60, found some more money, continued to test it. They dropped our module, put a crack in it, and it went all the way through to 100 years testing, at which time they stopped it. Now, what is the secret is basically it's our module is glass on glass instead of glass on Tedlar. And so there isn't any moisture intruding into the module. We seal that module very tightly on the edge with the same material that's used in hurricane glass windows and bulletproof glass. So that creates a very rigid module. I mean, it is flexible, but it's very rigid. And, we had throughout this testing process 0% degradation, which meant, it was unheard of. Quite frankly, in all of our financial assumptions, we had always thought that the solar cells themselves would decline and degrade somewhat, but amazingly they didn't. And again, the secret was, there was no moisture getting into that module whatsoever. You asked questions about the glass, and I got to confess I'm a financial guy, I'm not the technical guy, so I can't answer all your questions. The ingots for the silicon that we use, I can confirm most of it comes from Moses Lake, Washington. And we do try to buy our cells directly from the United States. As you know, all the companies that produce cells in the U.S. are subject to global markets, global demand. And Europe has been a huge demand for even U.S. solar cell manufacturers. And as a result, we've been unable to source from the U.S. Right now, we're sourcing our module, or our solar cells are coming from Taiwan. Now, our business model, we always look in-state first to see if we can't derive that product in-state. If we can't, then we look nationally, and only then do we, expand to look internationally. Right now, that's the only component of our module that is foreign sourced. The majority of everything else is sourced here locally, including the framing, and I believe the front part of the glass comes from Cardinal Glass, which is located here in Minnesota. I believe the back part of the glass is not located here. It comes from a company that I believe is in Oregon. Maybe in Vancouver, Washington, across the river. I'm not sure. Anyway, go ahead.
Representative Kwama, a brief follow-up.
Okay. Well, I would like a better understanding and, you know, from maybe contact information from your technical person, and I'm familiar with your Minnesota Glass provider. Do we have, you're talking about Europe, so on the European Commission and Union, they have an environmental reach program which looks at the use of materials and chemicals in your production, and then in your final product, even if they're inert there, if they are possible in any form. So do you have a report for REACH qualification? And then do you also have Rojas and other, you know, industry and international qualifications for the product?
You know, I'll be
Mr.
honest.
Mr. Carroll.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. I know, because I've heard Gary Shaver, our president, mention that we have a very sustainable product that is very inert in the manufacturing process. Again, I'm the financial guy. I'm not the technical guy. So I'd like to be able to get back with you with the details on that.
Thank you, Mr. Carroll. Representative Scott had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions, one for Jason Edens and one for Ms. Lundberg, if they would want to come forward. Or I guess that's your duty, Ms. Chair, to ask them.
No, that's
Chair
fine.
To ask them to come forward.
Do you know who you want to ask first?
Shall I go ahead?
Go ahead.
Mr. Edens, my first question was for you on this energy assistance photo that you have in your packet.
Yes, ma'am.
And I'm just wondering what that panel or panels cost, you know, the total cost of those panels, adding those panels.
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chair?
Mr. Edens.
Typically, a residential solar assistance installation or solar thermal installation for low-income families has a turnkey cost of about $4,000 to $5,000. So when we're displacing delivered fuels in particular, we're looking at a very rapid return on that. And again, it's, in our thinking, a much wiser use of public dollars in the energy assistance context. So somewhere between $4,000 and $5,000.
Okay,
Representative Scott.
And you said for energy assistance people, what is it if it's between $4,000 and $5,000 for them? What is it for me if I want to get that same panel on my house?
That's a great
Mr.
question.
Edens.
Madam Chair, excuse me. If it were a market rate installation, which our organization does as well, it is typically a little bit more costly. Our solar assistance program delivers at a razor thin margin. So obviously, as a nonprofit, we're very invested in delivering this service and advancing this innovative solution. So we do it at a threadbare margin. If it were market rate, it would probably be somewhere between $5,000 to $6,000 or thereabouts.
Okay.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. And in this situation, was the person in this photo, were they the homeowners or were they renting?
They're
Mr.
typically
Edens.
Homeowners. I'm sorry.
That's all right. It's Chair. Just for the tape. Later, I'm sure everybody's going to want to go listen to this tape because it'll help them get to sleep and they'll want to know who's speaking. So, Mr. Chair. Edens.
Yes, they are homeowners, in fact. We are, of course, wanting to empower families and not landlords. So typically, our low-income recipients are homeowners. However, we've often worked and partnered with HRA, Habitat for Humanity, Section 8 housing, and other affordable housing models. And in that case, we partner with that organization in order to reduce the overall long-term operating cost of a home or an apartment or multifamily dwelling.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My last question is, did the homeowner contribute to any of that $4,000 to $5,000?
Madam Chair?
Mr. Edens.
Typically, they do not. The families that we serve through our solar assistance program are literally families that struggle to make January's heating bill or February's heating bill. Oftentimes, these families are making very difficult choices between home heating and other competing basic necessities like health care. In the most severe cases, we're literally looking at a heat or eat scenario. So the families are not required to pay anything for the service. However, families often do contribute sweat equity when it's possible, but typically we're providing this in lieu of conventional energy assistance. And finally, families are often able to walk away from the energy assistance program as a result of this, because the typical Midwestern energy assistance recipient household gets 14% of their heating bill paid for. We're often doing somewhere between 15 and 30%. So rather than families being dependent on energy assistance, they're now empowered and no longer need the service, which means those scarce resources can go to other families in Minnesota.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. And then what's the lifespan on these panels,
Mr.
Eanes? Typically, the lifespan is somewhere between 30 and 40 years.
Okay.
We don't, unfortunately, have a similar testing standard that Silicon Energy has spoken about in the solar thermal industry. We are, however, an SRCC-certified collector, which has very rigorous performance and durability standards. So we estimate it somewhere between 3 to 4 decades.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. And then thank you, Mr. Eanes. And then to Ms. Lenderberg, if I might. You stated that solar is in high demand and people want to have this added to their homes and that there's a waiting list. But if I wanted to go get solar panels put on my house right now, I could go out and do that. Is that correct?
Ms. Lundberg.
Madam Chair, that's absolutely correct. But what happens, we fondly call it the solar coaster, because if you know that there's rebate funds available and a tax credit, you're going to buy now. But then it runs out really quickly in Minnesota, like in a matter of weeks or months. And so now there is none. But alas, if you wait 6 months or 9 months, there'll be rebate funds again. And so then people scurry to get their applications in, but then it runs out again. And so it's like if you knew a pair of shoes was going to be on sale next week for 50% off, you wouldn't buy it today. And that's what it's done to the solar industry. And it's a dilemma because, unfortunately, with no rebate funds, people would just be of the mindset that, well, it's too expensive. And some of them would say, it's just too expensive, I can't afford it. But sometimes there are rebate funds, and so it's a real uncertainty in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Representative Scott.
Thank you. And then just kind of on that same note, I read an article recently, I think it was an editorial, I don't remember, in the Wall Street Journal, and it was, I don't remember the fellow's name, I don't have the document here. But he was a real defender of renewable energies, and one of the things he noted was that, and I'd like to get your reaction to this, is he felt that rather than putting money into these subsidies and rebate programs and all those sorts of things on renewable energy, his take was that sooner or later it will become affordable if we invest that money instead into the technology to make it affordable, so that there's not this big difference right now in the price per kilowatt hour, as you know, there's this pretty big chasm right now between, you know, coal powered and some of the renewables. So I'm just wondering what your reaction to that is, if you think that that is a valid argument, and you would like to see the money go towards research and investments in technology to make it more affordable in the long run, or if you think the subsidies is the better route to go.
Ms. Lundberg.
Madam Chair, it is a valid argument for someone who doesn't know the energy picture. On the other hand, it doesn't hold even a drop of water, because as Mr. Carroll said earlier, currently for every $22 that's given to the fossil fuel industry as a subsidy, a single dollar is given to the renewable energy industry as a subsidy. So if we go ahead and take away that $1, it doesn't make an even playing field. If we were to take away the $22, take away subsidies for everyone, absolutely, it's a good argument. And solar today could stand on its own. It can't stand on its own because of the fossil fuel industry is still being subsidized. Unfortunately, I'm not a politician, but I understand that there are very strong lobbyists in the fossil fuel industry, and it's harder to say no to those subsidies than it is to offer at least some incentive to the renewable energy industries. So that's what's happening. In addition, when I have trash, I have to pay someone to come pick it up. Unfortunately, someone who's a scoundrel might try to just throw that trash in the street and get away with polluting for free. Some of us feel that that's sort of what's happening with the current industry. When we burn things, whether it be coal or petroleum or natural gas, we are creating pollution. And there is no cost currently at a federal level for polluting. And so here we're talking about not really a balanced scale. We're talking about renewable energies that don't generate any pollution being subsidized significantly less than these energies that do pollute for free. So it's really not an even playing field, and as such, I don't at all agree with the article.
Representative Scott.
That's all my questions. I think Representative Beard will probably have some comments on that.
Okay. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is more of a just a general comment. First of all, thanks to the panel. I thought this was tremendous. And three of the testifiers mentioned Germany. And Representative Hackbarth, myself, I see Senator Anderson's here with the governor's office, and others went to about a little over a year ago. And we studied for a week intensively in Berlin, you know, Germany's efforts to have an 80% standard by 2050, weaning themselves off of nuclear and many other fossil fuels for renewables. And I know you're pretty full up with hearings, Madam Chair, but I think at some point in this committee, either through a formal hearing or maybe another kind of gathering, we bring in some of the folks from the U, and maybe if we can have some of the others from Germany, if they're cycling through town, which they often do, really delve into what they're doing there, because I think some of what they're doing may not be applicable to Minnesota, but a lot of what they're doing I think is, and you know, if they can do it in Germany, we certainly can do it here. And so I you know, really applaud this panel and look forward to working with many of you on in promoting solar this session.
Representative Hackbarth.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and to that point, Representative Hornstein, as you know, we did check this out in Germany, and they do things a lot different in Germany than we do here. I mean, it's a whole societal change that we'd have to go through to do it exactly the way Germany does it. It's a whole different aspect of the way they operate in Germany. So I just wanted to make that point, and we can have that discussion, but I wanted to make the point that it's a whole different ballgame over in Germany than it is here.
Thank you, Representative Hackbarth. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and clearly the committee needs to go to Germany. A quick question. First of all, the two people who are just up testifying, I don't have your names written down. If after the committee hearing I could just talk with each of you, I had just some questions I wanted to ask you offline. If you're available, I'd appreciate it. A question, this is really for anyone who wants to answer it, is as everybody knows, natural gas prices have gone through the floor for many reasons in the Midwestern area in the United States. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that. Does that present a challenge to the adoption of new technologies? And just offer your thoughts on how we have really record low prices in natural gas, and that's a significant financial incentive to use that. What your thoughts are on that. And that's to the testifier or anyone who wants to answer.
Mr. Hinkle.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo. Clearly it's a challenge to the solar industry. We think that we're in the process of meeting that challenge. There are a number of fairly significant, credible studies that have been developed over the last few years. There's a White House study that came out in 2010 that talked about solar reaching grid parity by 2015. There's a really credible, deeply researched study that was done by Piper Jaffray that indicated that it might be 2016, and there's a global data report that indicated that it's in that range that we're looking at solar being able to reach grid parity. Whatever that number is, our concern is that we see the market for solar developing and maturing at a relatively rapid pace. And to the point that we were making earlier, it's really critical in our view to position Minnesota now. If we wait for 2016, 2018, and we haven't taken advantage of the assets that we have in this state to create the jobs and the economic development that we could from a hub for solar, we will not be able to do that in 2016 or 2018.
Mr. Hagan?
Madam Chair. If I could address the question as well, the concerns of natural gas, yes, they do pose a challenge, and that stretches out our payback periods in solar thermal, especially that's a replacement for natural gas. There are, as was said before, as I said before, the fossil fuel industry is currently being incentivized, so we always have to bear that in mind, that we need to bring renewables ahead in the same manner as we're treating fossil fuels and incentivizing that industry. It's taken a lot of dollars. I don't have the total, but I'm sure millions, perhaps billions of dollars to develop the fracking technology that has led to the cheap natural gas prices. But natural gas is not going to stay that low forever, and we always have to keep that end game in mind, make sure solar thermal technologies are there to pick up when natural gas prices do start coming up. Things that are going to drive natural gas prices up for the past years, United States, I believe, has been a net importer of natural gas. For the first time, we are looking at becoming a net exporter. When those licenses do go through, and that does start to happen, natural gas prices are going to rise. As the economy gets back on track, natural gas is going to start to rise. So, yes, it is challenging now. It's even more important to incentivize renewable energy during this period of challenge.
Representative Beard, you have the last question of the day.
Well, Madam Chair, it's more a comment than anything. I'm thinking back to 1973, 74. I was a student at a Bible college out in Bloomington, and at the time, the president at that time wanted us to be energy independent and passed a whole series of incentives for solar energy. We actually had 22 patents on solar panels at that time, most of it on passive thermal type of installations. In 1986, whenever the Reagan and Tip O'Neill tax bill went through, all of a sudden the incentives became somebody's loophole and was a bad word, and so we closed them all, and the windmills and the solar panels went away, and we closed our solar facility because no one would buy it without the government incentives to make it work. But somewhere in my office I have a poster from those days. Jimmy Carter wanted to make sure that we had a Manhattan Project for solar so that by the year 2000, 20% of our power would come from solar, and we have spent almost $6 billion at the federal level incentivizing solar up to the year 2000. Now, I don't know what we've done since, but it's been a bunch, and I'm just sitting here having deja vu. Now, we just had Groundhog Day here the other day, so maybe this is a good day to talk about Groundhog Day all over again. But there are just a couple comments. As we go forward and we think about this, it probably would be good to have an economist listen to some of our conversation, because there was several comments made about this is about jobs. I would argue that it's not, but we talk about jobs, and one gentleman commented that makes more jobs per kilowatt hour than any other source of electricity we have. I have an idea for you. At our county fair every year, the Minnesota Valley Electric Cooperative puts up some stationary exercise bikes with a generator on them, just to show you how hard it is, how much energy it takes to light a 100-watt light bulb. If you want jobs, we could put a whole room full of those together all over the country. Members, I'd encourage you to think in terms of productivity and efficiency. When we're coming to the such thing as basic as baseload power that allows us to refine ore or mill corn or sterilize instruments or heat our homes and our schools and our factories in this state and this climate, productivity and efficiency are much more precious to us than the number of jobs it takes to crank out a kilowatt of electricity. That is a fundamental fact that we need to hold in front of us at all times when we consider everything we do in this committee. Just one other one, because it just gets my goat. $22 of subsidy for every dollar of solar. I would like to challenge that at some day on what the methodology is, what it actually is we're comparing, total dollars, dollars per BTU. What is that? Over what period of time, and so on and so forth? And if we're interested in fossil fuel and in leveling the playing field, I think you'd find every Republican in this place willing to repeal any so-called subsidy to the fossil fuel industry instead of jacking up subsidies to the renewable energy industry. I think that would be more fair, transparent, and economically responsible thing to do. There's so much more to talk about, but in the interest of time, I'll hold my comments to another day.
Thank you, Representative Beard, and I'm sure we will have legislation on this matter, and we'll have an opportunity to have this conversation with respect to specific proposals. Unfortunately, I think the subsidies that we're talking about are federal, and so maybe we need to write to our congressman about that. But members, on Tuesday, we're having a joint hearing with the Senate committee. We are going to be looking at energy efficiency. You heard some of the presenters today talk about how that is the lowest cost method to deal with our energy needs, and so we're going to explore that issue in depth tomorrow. And thank you very much to all the presenters for coming here today to the State Capitol and presenting your information, and please keep in touch with us as the session goes on and as we start to look at specific proposals. Members, we're adjourned.